Hello, this is Chris Robinson, writer and producer of the Forbidden Diary audio drama. On projects like Forbidden Diary, coincidences and serendipity happen. Both occurred when I cast Karen DeBoer, who plays Enid. As it turns out, her mother and stepfather and their families were interned at the same time as the Crowders, but in Manila at a civilian prison camp called Santo Tomas. I interviewed Karen's stepfather, Kurt Brooks. Kurt is 96 years old. His story parallels Beattie Crowder's. His parents were Americans with deep ties to the Philippines, considered it their home. Kurt was roughly the same age as Beattie, and he and his family were interned for the entire war. Kurt's story is so compelling and sweeping, his interview took nearly 3 hours, that I've broken up our conversation into 3 segments that follow the Crowder's story. This first segment covers the pre-war years, December 8, and events leading up to internment. Let's take a listen in. Welcome, Kurt. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good to be here.
So just out of the gate here, I have to ask, did you know or your family know the Crowders at all?
I went to Brent School in Baguio in 1938 to 39. And the name rings a very faint bell. One of the children may have been in the school, but I, beyond the very faint bell, I can't say that I knew anybody from that family.
You were interned for the entire war at Santo Tomas, right?
That's correct.
And you were just a kid. How old were you?
I was 13 when the war broke and 16 when we were liberated. 3 years, 37 months.
Let's start by going back. Were you born in the Philippines?
Yes, I was born in Manila.
And what took your family to the Philippines?
My dad was hired by a company in New York, which owned the Manila Electric Company. He was hired to help build the steam generating plant in downtown Manila. And my mother went out there in 1923. He worked on the construction of the power plant, and then he stayed on to become supervisor of power plants for the Manila Electric Company. And my brother and I was a twin, were born in 1928.
And so you always lived in Manila?
Right. Manila was our home. And about every 3 years or so, my parents were granted what they call home leave. But for us, it was just a vacation. And leave took us back to the United States. And we visited relatives and then went back really to our home. The last such so-called vacation was in 1938. And we went from Manila to Singapore to Ceylon through the Suez Canal into Genoa in Italy. And then we were due to go to Germany. My mother's family was German. But that was at the time of the Munich crisis, and my dad thought it was wise not to go to Germany at that time, so we went to Paris instead, and finally to the United States, taking the Canadian Pacific steamer, the Empress of Japan, I think it was called.
That's ironic.
Right, kind of ominous. And a fellow passenger on that ship was a man named Dwight Eisenhower. Yeah, he was going to join MacArthur's staff in Manila. And my dad played bridge quite a bit, and I don't think they were paired, but he was in the same little foursome with Eisenhower playing bridge almost the whole way across.
So you grew up in the Philippines and Manila. What are your recollections of what it was like back in the 30s?
Well, that's quite a kaleidoscope of memories. And I could go on for quite a while, but we went to the American school, which was almost entirely American students. A lot of the Filipinos that we came in contact with spoke English, and so there wasn't a tendency to learn the local language. We did learn some cuss words. We were a fairly close-knit community in Manila, the American community, and there was a club in Pasay, the suburb of Manila, called the Polo Club, and that's what it was, a polo club. And my parents belonged to that, and we spent quite a bit of time there. They had a swimming pool and bowling alleys and tennis courts and so on. And it was a fallback for us for a lot of our, let's say, non-school activities.
But you were in the Depression. This was not a bad place to be. I've read multiple accounts that many Americans had quite a good life in the Philippines. Did you have cooks and drivers and nannies?
Yes, we had a house girl and a house boy and a cook. And the house girl, I remember, was Felicidad, and a very faithful servant. And we've had two or three different house boys.
You were young, but do you recall the adults talking about Japan before the war? Do you recall any conversations? And if so, what was the prevailing attitude?
Yes, and indeed, we were very alert to the international situation, at least certainly in our family, and I think that was generally true. You know, there was a war in Asia almost the entire 30s. Japan attacked Manchuria in 1931, and then China itself in 1937, and that war went on forever. And of course, many of our friends were British, and when the war in Europe broke out, they were concerned and involved. And so we were quite alert to the events taking place in the rest of the world.
Were people thinking it's going to happen any minute at all? It'll never happen here. Were there two camps, or was there a prevailing opinion?
It's hard to say. I do know in our family, my dad expressed the opinion a number of times that Japan could not possibly win a war with the United States, and therefore they wouldn't go to war with the United States. I think he was set in that opinion and confirmed it.
Well, he certainly wasn't the only one.
No, I know. I'm sure that besides that, we had, an optimistic view of the ability of the American Army to defend the Philippines, and that if war broke, that we might be bombed and that sort of thing, but that there would not be an invasion. I think it was a rumor or a quote, but somebody said that MacArthur claimed he could defend these islands against a million men. And, so, you know, there was that kind of confidence in the defense of the islands.
So you and parents made a conscious decision to stay in the Philippines.
Yes, but remember, my dad and my mother had lived there since 1923 and had the children there and his career and friends and community were all there in Manila. Yeah, that was our home, and we were going to stick with it.
When the first bombings happened, the first ones were on Baguio and then Clark Field, I would imagine you were in shock.
Of course, the war broke out on December 8th. So we were on the other side of the dateline. The first thing my brother and I knew about war was a friend of ours came up and said, "How do you like being at war?" We were waiting at the school, in the front of the school, and for the school to open.
Now, was this in the school in Manila or Brent School up in Baguio?
No, this is Manila. I was in Baguio from 1938 to 39. And we said, what do you mean? And he said, well, the Japanese have bombed Honolulu. That's the way the story came up. And it was a strange environment or strange atmosphere, let's say, because we weren't sure what was going on. Manila was very tranquil that morning. Business went on as usual, and at least as far as we were concerned. And I can remember our teacher, Mrs. Youngberg, who was not so young. We called her Spring Chicken. Standing in front of the class and wringing her hands and say, it's all rumor. I don't believe a word of it. It's all rumor. There's nothing to it. Well, she was wrong. But I could go back a little bit further. And the weekend before Pearl Harbor, before December 8th, the American school basketball team went up to Baguio to play Brent School. And a bunch of the students were allowed to accompany the team as fans. So we went up to Baguio by train and by bus and stayed at the Baguio Hotel and watched the basketball game. That was, we went up Friday afternoon, stayed there Saturday for the game, and returned Sunday afternoon to Manila. And by then, the situation in the Far East was very tense, very tense. And to the point where on the morning of December 7th, Sunday morning, my brother and I and two friends were in Session Road in Baguio, and there was to be an air raid drill that morning, and everybody had to go inside and take shelter. Well, we thought better of that and thought we'd go to a movie and take shelter in a movie. Why not? I called Mrs. Croft, who's the principal of the school, who was the chaperone for that whole group, and asked her if we could go to the movies. She said yes. And then I said to her, Mrs. Croft, are we at war yet? The situation was that tense that I, as an eighth grader, about 18 hours before Pearl Harbor, thought it was appropriate to ask if war had come yet. And she replied, no, I don't think so. I think we would have heard. On the return to Manila on the train, there was an Air Force sergeant who was also traveling on the train. He'd been on leave, and he said, we go up every day in flying patrols and B-70s, the B-17 crewmen, and we carry live bombs. He said, we're going to be at war within a month. He was killed the next day. That we found out later. But anyway, over time, the Japanese first attacked China and took Shanghai and Canton and all the principal cities. And then in 1940, with the fall of France, they moved into northern French Indochina. And then in July of 1941, they moved into South French Indochina, into Saigon and that area. And the only reason for that we could see for that move into South French Indochina had nothing to do with the war in China, was to prepare for an invasion of Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And so it was...
And people were still optimistic that nothing was going to happen.
Yeah, that's right. But there was a sense that, a very strong sense that war was coming. My dad persisted in saying they'd be foolish to attack the United States. They're not going to win. And I think my brother and I inherited that optimism.
Did you hear bombs going off in Manila?
Yes, well... When school ended on December 8th, and we still didn't know what was going on, and my dad came home at lunchtime, because school was out at 12:30, and he picked us up in the car, and we got in the car, bubbly over with excitement. Dad, what's this about war? And he said, yes, it's true. the Japanese have bombed Baguio and Clark Field. And Chris, that was a real shock to suddenly realize, yes, the future was not, is not the same.
Almost a physical feeling, I would think. Yes, it was.
It was a shock. I can remember to this day. The city had changed. The atmosphere had changed. And in fact, we had changed. There was now something so unpredictable that it was hard to get your senses around it.
And then the bombs happened, right?
Yeah, we lived within about a mile of Nichols Field.
Oh, wow.
So, yes, things went quiet. There was blackout. And then at about 3 in the morning, I was awakened by the sound of high-flying airplanes. And I called to my brother. I said, "Do you hear that?" And he said, "Yes, I think there are." And just then it came the loudest explosions I'd ever heard, and each one sounding closer. And I have never since been so terrified as I was at that moment. And it was a sickening feeling that people were trying to kill us. They're doing their best to do so. The planes droned on, and I lived in a blue funk for the rest of the night from 3 a.m. to...
It was real.
It was real, yes. And
what did your parents do?
Well, after that, we sort of resumed the routines of living, but school was canceled. And December 9th, the rest of the day was pretty quiet. But then the next day, on December 10th, we were sitting down to lunch, and a plane passed over very low, and it was firing. We could hear the machine guns going. And we had a kind of a spot in the ground floor of the house that we used more as a shelter, but it was hardly a shelter at all. And we went down there, and for maybe... an hour or so while the planes strafed Nichols Field and bombed, and the bombing was rather close. And we, when there was a lull, we went across the street because the people over there had a better shelter than we did, and we stayed there till it was clear that the attack was over. But you know, I was far less frightened when that more intense bombing took place than that first night. That first night was a cruel shock, so to speak. My dad decided to move to Malati, a residential area. Friends of my dad from the company, Jim Koch and his wife Edith, had an apartment there, and we moved in with them.
Why did you do that?
It was in an apartment house, much stronger than our wood frame house. It was also 5 miles from Nichols Field.
What were other people doing? Were they doing the same thing as your parents, getting their families away from Nichols Field and living other places?
Some people left and went to the provinces for a while, but eventually they all came back. It was clear that the Japanese bombing was after military objectives. They were bombing Nichols Field and also the... ships in the bay, but they bombed every day.
But Manila was declared an open city, so the sense was that they wouldn't bomb downtown.
Well, the open city was declared, I think, shortly before the Japanese entered the city. Whatever the message was, it didn't get to the Japanese because they continued to bombing the city. They went after the ships in the Pasig River, and of course they missed and hit Latron College and other places in the walled city and so on, because the walled city's right there on the Pasig. And then came the news, big headlines in the paper, 80 Jap transports sighted in Lingayen Gulf. And I can remember as an eighth grader looking at my dad and say, "Dad, we've lost this. Americans haven't put 80 transports worth of stuff in these islands in 40 years, much less in one shot like that." And of course, that proved to be true. And few days later, there was the landing at a place called Antiboden on the east coast of Luzon, and so you had fighting a front up near Lingayen Gulf, and then one south of Manila at Tayabas Province in that area.
And what's remarkable to me about Natalie's story was that the Japanese took over so quickly. I mean, I was counting your diary entries. I think it was 21 days from the first bomb dropping to them being marched to a prison camp. What was your experience in Manila during those 3 weeks? What did your family and friends do?
Before the Japanese occupied the city, they bombed it every day. We spent quite a bit of time, and that building was a solid concrete building, and it had a basement, which was unusual in Manila, and a kind of an incinerator down there, and sandbags around it. And we spent quite a bit of time. There was a bombing over at Cavite, the Navy Yard, and a lot of people had run out to watch these strange planes flying over, and many people were killed because they were standing there watching the aircraft. So my mother was very strict on our not going to the door of the shelter and looking up at the airplane. I did from time to time, but did a lot of reading, I can remember. We had some books by P.G. Wodehouse, and they were kind of uplifting in a dark time.
When the Japanese did take over, where were you and what happened?
We were still at the Cokes, and the headline in the newspaper that morning was that USAFI forces united. USAFI was the term for the American Army, United States Army Forces in the Far East, an acronym. And it said the forces fighting the Japanese north and south of Manila have been united north of Manila. This leaves the way to Manila open. So we knew they were going to be occupied.
So you heard it through the newspaper?
Yes. Days before they got there, we knew they were coming. And
what did you do?
I'll tell you one thing we did was to get rid of the liquor. The Cokes were childless and lived well, and liquor was cheap out there. And we spent quite a bit of time pouring Johnny Walker down the drain.
Oh, I thought you'd pour Johnny Walker down your throats. Why did you dump all the alcohol? Maybe you could have used it for money later on.
Because there was concern, Chris, because of the rape of Nanking, that Japanese would get drunk and be barbaric. And of course, that was a legitimate fear. But it turned out that the occupation was quite peaceful. And as the Japanese once said during internment, when we are victorious, we can afford to be magnanimous. And I think that was a kind of a rule of thumb for their occupation of Manila. They thought they were coming as liberators. And what did they find? But in time, of course, the bulk of the forces they were fighting were Filipinos. So illusion didn't last too long, but it was, I think, part and parcel of their approach to the Philippines and to Manila.
So were you invited, so to speak, to come to Santo Tomas?
We were rounded up. They started rounding up Americans and allied civilians. It took them in buses and trucks to Santo Tomas. And there was a committee formed before the war to prepare the American community for what might happen should the Japanese take over. And one of the things they did was to locate possible internment sites. And one of those internment sites was the Santo Tomas University. I think this committee met with the Japanese and suggested if they were going to intern Americans, they do it at Santo Tomas. So part of the selection of that campsite was due to American foresight that we might be occupied by the enemy. I say, as soon as the Japanese got into them, got into the city, they started rounding up. It was not a vast sweep, but in rather small groups and that sort of thing.
Was that your experience?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
We were at the Cokes, and the Japanese army was very much in evidence. And they set up a radio station right across the street from us, and we could hear the whine of their generators for that. But we were undisturbed. A Japanese civilian my dad knew came to the apartment, and he said that we would be taken to Santo Tomas, where we would be interned. So we knew that that was what was going on. And the newspaper stopped, by the way, of course.
So did a bus pull up in front of your apartment? And
I think a civilian came and told us the bus was waiting, and could bring food and clothing for 3 days, I think was the going phrase. And then we got on the bus, and obviously the Japanese community was in high spirits, and the driver we had to the Santo Tomas was in high spirits, and I think he'd been lubricating those spirits best he could, because he was carrying on, and he said, "I hope you all have insurance," because he was driving fairly recklessly. So it was kind of a strange introduction to internment.
Did you pack anything special that you took with you, you know?
My dad had been down there to the house a number of times because we needed stuff at the Cokes, but we didn't go with him, and he didn't stay very long. Again, it was, I think, less than a mile from Nichols Field. But we drove into the gates of Santo Tomas, and my parents were never to leave.
Your whole family spent the whole duration in Santo Tomas.
Yeah.
Be sure to tune in for the next episode of Forbidden Diary, the true World War II story of Natalie Crowder, based on her secret journal written from a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines.